Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. It's a beautiful day today, even though it's pouring outside and I don't really care. But this show is going to really be fantastic. This is MJ Network, MJ in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, that started me on this career to do this. And I am so pumped. We have four of the best authors in the universe today to talk about strong female characters. So those of you out there that are listening, and I know you're listening really hard, if you want to write a book, you need to listen to what they're saying about strong female characters. We have one of my favorite people in the universe, John Land. We have R.G. Belsky, we have Philip Margolin, who I adore, and Alan Topol, and I am so excited. So welcome, everybody, and I'm here, finally. And
hi, friend.
Hi.
Hi, friend.
Hi, John. Hi.
Hello.
Everybody. And R.G., how you doing today? I hope you're better. Anyway. When creating your female characters, this is a question for anybody, how did you create their personality and vocation? And how did they evolve from the first time you meet them until the present? Because that's something that a lot of authors don't do very well.
I think for me, with my Texas Ranger, Caitlin Strong, I'll answer the second question first because it's the one that's on my mind that I remember. As you get older, you know, you don't remember the first question. You only remember the second. But Caitlin's evolution, and I think any character's evolution, is based on the characters with whom she interacts, or any character interacts, because the golden rule, the gasoline that drives a story, is conflict. And how do you define the conflict? What is driving the characters? What's driving Caitlin Strong? What defines Caitlin Strong, which is what comes out in her interpersonal relationships between with other characters. To give you a specific example, when I started the book, I knew one of the things I wanted to do was invert the traditional Western gunfighter story, even though I was writing about a modern Texas Ranger. My female would be the one who would have who would be the free spirit, the lone gunman, the person uncomfortable living among other people. The male lead, her outlaw lover, as people call him, Court Wesley Masters, who she once put in prison, and he's the guy who has to raise his two teenage boys after their mother is murdered, in some ways thanks to Caitlin, unfortunately. So you've got these two kids that Caitlin finds herself kind of a surrogate mother for, especially after she saves their lives. Point I'm getting at is this. Her relationship with those two boys highlights the push and pull of her developing character. The push is her desire to be a loner, the classic gunfighter. The pull is the fact that she loves these two kids and wants to be their mother, which means she has to be more grounded in reality as in a traditional female role, which she can't do. And that push and pull becomes something that emotionally defines the series, book in, book out, with obviously some new nuances and twists thrown in.
This is Phil Margolin. And when I created Robin Lockwood, I have a lot of strong female characters in my books. And I was trying to figure out, they frequently will get in dangerous situations. And in real life, if a man and a woman fight, the man's usually going to win. They're bigger, stronger usually. So I was trying to figure out how could I sort of even up the odds. And that gave me an idea for the background for Robin. And so, and her motivation for becoming an attorney. So Robin works her way through Yale Law School by fighting on television in pay-per-view mixed martial arts bouts. And the background for that, how did she get involved as a UFC cage fighter, is that when she was a kid growing up in a small Midwestern town, her father and her three brothers all were wrestlers on the high school team.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted to be a wrestler. And when she tried, the school board, after complaints from parents, held that she couldn't be on the wrestling team. So her dad, who was very supportive, hired an attorney to sue the school board. And the attorney won and was able to get her into the on the wrestling team. And that motivated her to become an attorney later in life. So the whole combat theme, being a wrestler in high school as a girl, and then later on getting into mixed martial arts, is a sort of a thread that pulls her into the law.
God, that is interesting. And besides, I'd like to take some lessons from her.
Well, as a graduate of the Yale Law School, I am proud to hear that you're working the Yale Law, it's Alan Topol, that you're working the Yale Law School in your book. But on the subject of women, I have an interesting story to tell you, and it ties in to my book. This is Alan Topol. So many years ago, in 1979, I had a terrific editor who was sort of an icon in the area, Howard Cady, working at William Morrow. They did my first book. This was my second. And it involves the critical point is the assassination of a Mossad agent in Bethesda, Maryland. And then the Mossad sends, Israel sends another agent to find out what happened and avenge his death. And in the first draft, the new agent they sent was a man. And so my editor, Howard Cady, reads this book, and I'm anxious, what's he going to think? And he says, I love your book, but I think you should make your new agent a woman. Now, this is 1979. I mean, that was a long time ago. And I said, sure. And so we ended up with a woman of valor in Leora, and the book did very well, and I stupidly killed her off at the end of the book. I could have used her. But fast forward, now I've got a new series, as you know, Fran, involving Kelly Cameron. And I know you like Craig Page, but Kelly Cameron is in the new book, which just came out, The Washington Operator. It's the third Kelly Cameron book. And so here I am trying to create this strong female character working for the FBI, a single mom. And I must say it's an awful lot of fun, and it seems to be working well to make her tough yet, you know, human, and working in a, particularly with the FBI, it's a male dominated world, and she's struggling, but doing very, very well, and I'm having a lot of fun with it, and reader reaction seems to be quite good.
Oh, you're going to get mine very soon, as soon as I get it. Don't worry.
Next week, I promise.
That's right. Just add it to my pile of a million. Did we, RG, what do you have?
John,
what, about
what do you think of women?
What do I think of women characters? I tell you very honestly, there's a whole bunch of them that I'm reading, and your four are fantastic, but then there's a whole group that I've been reading that I could live without, that they are obstetrous, they are overpowering at times, and sometimes they just go too far. So
yeah.
Whatever you guys are doing, great. I'm reading a few right now, as a matter of fact. I'm reading the new Clancy book, which is interesting, and some of the female characters are really good. And the one, this Amanda Watson, that's ahead of iCloud, I don't trust her. I can tell you that, and she's supposed to be good. It's a new Jack Ryan series. So some of the female characters are great, and some of them could use a little help from you guys to write them, because they don't.
But you know, you made a good point, Fran, about going too far. It's not a book. It's a movie. But I just saw it 2 days ago, Late Night, the new Emma Thompson book. I don't know if anybody's movie. I don't know if anybody saw it, but that's an example of having gone too far. I mean, I think they created a totally ridiculous character, and it just didn't do any good for the point they were trying to make. I don't know. Others may disagree.
I'm sorry. Someone else going to talk?
No, you are.
Oh, go ahead, Phil.
I sort of had the reverse situation in 1978 from the one that Alan was talking about with his editor. My very first book came out in 1978. I was a full-time lawyer, and the writing was just sort of almost like a hobby. And after Heartstone was published, the editor at Pocketbooks asked me if I wanted to do a series with a female prosecutor. And I was in my 30s. You know, this was back before women really got involved with law, and I panicked. And I said, you know, I can't write a female character as a, you know, main character in a book, and I turned them down. So then I wrote another book that with a male character, The Last Innocent Man, with David Nash as the main character. And then I stopped writing for about 12 years to concentrate on my law practice. So then in 1992, I got an idea for Gone But Not Forgotten, which was my first bestseller. And it's about a serial killer who dehumanizes women before he kills them. And I started the book off with David Nash from my last book, a male. But I have represented serial killers as an attorney. I did about 30 homicides, and I've represented serial killers along with other types of murderers. And the first scene where the lawyer, David, meets the serial killer is in a high-rise office building after everybody has left. It's just the cleaning crews. It's a very spooky scene. Mm-hmm. And it dawned on me that if I had a male, because when I'm in a contact visiting room with someone who's taken a human life, your antenna goes up a little, but if the serial killer kills women, you know you're not their type, so you don't get as nervous. But I'm thinking, what if the serial killer is meeting with a woman lawyer? And I realized the tension level would go through the ceiling. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to do a sex change operation on my main character. I need to have a woman. But I panicked again. And I said, how am I going to do this? And then all of a sudden I thought, well, who's the toughest guy you know? And my first wife, Doreen, passed away in 2007, but she was an attorney and a really tough guy attorney. And I thought, well, I'll use a crutch. Every time I write a scene with Betsy Tannenbaum, who's the main character in Gone But Not Forgotten, I'll pretend it's my wife. And I will just imagine her in the scene, and I'll imagine how she would talk and what she would do. And by the end of the book, I'd gotten over my fear of women, and then about half of my 22 novels have main characters who are women, and I'm not scared of them anymore.
Well, I reviewed that book, by the way, and I did read it. I think I read everything you wrote, just about, pretty much.
You know, Fran, this is John Land. It's interesting. Am I right in saying that I haven't heard a woman's voice yet? So we have four guys on the phone on your show talking about how to write women. It's interesting. If having a female perspective might have been a nice touch, but the fact that we're all guys kind of allows us to get into more of how we did what we did. In my case, I think I think it was Philip. Might have been. I forgot who it was now because all these points have been so good. But anyway, the idea that it was Philip. The idea that a woman does not have the same physical capabilities as a guy is definitely a limiting factor in the sense that when you look at the thrillers that are by traditional male authors, the Brad Thors, the Brad Taylors, Steve Barry, James Rollins, the action thrillers, you can't have there. You know, it's Navy SEALs, it's Delta Force, it's ex-Green Berets. It's the same thing, only different. So you can't have a Navy SEAL female, regardless of Demi Moore. You can't have a Delta Force or a Green Beret. Although women do serve in the special forces, they do not serve in combat. They don't go through the same training. They do in the Marines, but they are not eligible at present for Marine Force Recon, which is their version of the special forces. So when I was looking, and by the way, Caitlin Strong, as I've told many times, was basically invented at a marketing meeting when the head of paperback sales back then, when there were paperbacks that were selling, said, thrillers are the number one genre, and women buy 70% of all books. Why are there no action heroes who are women? And right on the spot, I said, what about a female Texas Ranger? Because that was something that had a historical precedent. But to the point, another great point that someone else made about the idea of creating credibility for how the woman I love Phillip's notion about the wrestling, because not only is it a great way to develop physical strength and the ability to defend yourself, but it also is the conflict with their brothers. That's what I really loved about what you were talking about. But in the case of Caitlin Strong, to create credibility, I made her not just a Texas Ranger, but I made her a fifth-generation Texas Ranger. So she is accepted into the ranks of a male-dominated society because of her heritage. And because of that heritage, she has a very high bar. It's almost at times like she's neither male. She's more of a person and less of a gender. Maybe Caitlin Strong invented gender fluidity. I don't know. But I think in the case of Caitlin Strong, she is defined often by her gun, what she does and how she deals with situations. And yet, I have to tell you, I can't picture her as a man any more than I can picture my number one male series hero, Blaine McCracken, as a woman. She's a real person to me. And I think when writing about women, hopefully drawing more of an audience for women, it challenges us for men, and this is something maybe the other guys want to comment on. It challenges us as men, because action thrillers can succeed without – they can be empty and vacant of emotion, and they can still work. But if you're going to attract a female audience, emotion must be front and center, especially when you're dealing with a female lead. So it challenges us to add more emotion, more – character development into our work, because the subgenre of a female thriller hero, or even in some cases a female mystery hero, heroine or hero, whatever you want to say, it demands us to reach beyond our comfort zone and do things that we would not necessarily do if our characters were male leads. Does that resonate with anybody else, or did
Dick,
I just say
there?
Something
can
that
you...
absurdly sexist?
Archie, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I hear you. Now I hear you. Dick was trying to answer before. He doesn't. Can you hear me? I don't know. I asked him before. Dick, can you hear me? I can't hear you.
I can hear you fine, Fran.
Yeah, Dick, can you hear me? Of course, he just logged out. He's going to log back in.
Okay.
So the next question is, because he said, can I hear him? Because he's trying to respond, and I don't know. He just private messaged me. So your female character is about to speak. And, you know, I just read something. I don't know if you read W.H. Wheaton's Emily Eternal. It's about an artificial consciousness. It's a character that really doesn't exist, but she really does exist, and she's really a tough female character. She's great. He's coming on next Thursday. So what would your female character say as her strong points, and which ones would she like to improve on, and what conflicts do they feel that they could have done better at if they had some male backup that might have helped them a little bit more? That was really tough.
Well,
wait, he's here.
This,
Archie, are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me now, Fran?
Yes, okay. The question is, what would your female character, Claire Carlson, say as her strong points, and what would she say that she would like to improve on? And if she had some backup, who would she want to back her up? That's the next question.
Okay. Well, let me just go back since I missed the first. I mean,
okay.
I heard every bit of the first 20 minutes, and it was fascinating. And let me just a couple comments to everybody because I'm sitting here desperately trying to respond. First off, it's great to be on a show with Philip because Gone But Not Forgotten, if anybody hasn't read it, is really one of the great books I've ever read. I read that back, I guess it was in the 90s, Philip, when it came out, and that kind of like inspired me to be. I was like, wow, this is a great serial killer book. And she was a great female character, too. So, you know, that's a real classic. And, Alan, I have a story virtually identical to yours about my first book. I actually wrote it about the same time you were, back when there weren't a lot of great women characters, you know, before the Janet Ivanoviches and Sarah Paretsky's and stuff came along. And I basically had written a male character because I was a man, and I worked in a newspaper and was a male reporter, and a woman friend who was in publishing read it, and she said, what would happen if you turned the character into a woman? And I did the exact same thing you did, and I was very, very happy to do it. And then just in terms of the original question, I'm sorry, but I just, like, was listening to all you guys, and Jonathan, who I've been on the show a couple times, but Jonathan, and I always say, like, I pretty much 100% always agree with everything he says, which is really very annoying, actually. But I actually agree on the question of the – kind of disagree on the question of the evolution of the character, because, and I know I'm just being a little cantankerous here, but, you know, we all talk about, you know, the character evolves and changes and all this stuff, and there's a part of me that kind of goes, you know, love the old Larry David, Jerry Seinfeld approach, you know, which worked pretty well on that show, which is nobody grows, nobody changes, nobody learns anything. You know, they just keep going on like that. And to a degree, I think my character, Claire Carlson, professionally is like that. I mean, she's got a lot of great strong points. She's a great reporter. She's really smart. She's honest. But she's got a lot of flaws, too. And I don't think that character really changes. Now, having said that, on a personal level, she does have to evolve. And I have been trying to do that in the book. Anyway, those are all the thoughts that I've had pent up in me for the last few minutes. I've been listening to all the great conversations with you guys. So go ahead.
Okay, the question was, I'll repeat it because I forgot. No, it's in front of me. What would your female character say are her strong points, and what do you think she still has to work on? Not that Caitlin really has to work very hard, because she's more like me than anybody else's character. And I'm beginning to wonder if I should go to, you know, class with Robin, too, because she's tough, too. So what conflicts have they faced, and do they really need a male backup, or can they handle this on their own?
Well, Fran, it's Alan. Let me just respond to your question by talking about the sort of the beat I work in is Washington, as you know. I mean, having spent my whole career here with a big law firm, and my books, many of them are very Washington-centric. And I had a lot of fun with creating Kelly Cameron, the rising FBI agent, because Washington at the top level is still an enormously male-dominated society. It's a male-dominated club. I don't care how many women are running for president and how many, you know, there are more in Congress now, but the real power, it's still a male-dominated town. And this is what Kelly runs into when she's, for example, forced to go up and testify before a congressional committee. And so I think that's one of the things she struggles with. And that's one of the things that I want to bring out in the book for people, for readers to understand. That's how the real Washington operates. And Kelly's problem is how to accept this, how to deal with it, and still continue to do her job. So that's kind of my answer within the within the milieu I'm working, which is Washington.
In terms of you asked the question of a backup and should it be male or female. You know, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's something I've never really thought about. I, you know, in the Claire Carlson book, she has a best friend who's actually a female lawyer. She has a boss who's a male. She has a top aide at her station as a female. One of the advantages or disadvantages, either way you want to look at it, of writing a series about a journalist like I do, is it's not so much really about physical, you know, I mean, she's not going to go out and pull a gun on people or get a fist fight or things like that, like somewhat like a law enforcement person might be forced to do. And so a lot of what she's doing is, you know, is the media aspect, breaking stories. So for me, it's not that important. I don't necessarily stop and think, oh, this should be a man with her or a female. I just create the character. And, you know, as it turns out, she is surrounded by both men and women.
But what are the real what are the newsrooms like in some of the papers you worked with? Are some of them strongly male dominated?
Well, not anymore. I mean, I'm old enough, Alan, you and I go back a long ways. And
right.
I started out at the New York. I started out when there were very few women in the newsroom, and back in the 70s, and the women that were there basically were not allowed to do hard news. They did features and cooking and things like that. And that's all clearly changed over the years. And I've had the good fortune of working at the New York Post, but there actually were a lot of women before their time who were writing hard news stories when very few other women weren't. And that kind of really helped me create some of the characters, because they had to battle a lot of elements, you know. But you know, today, obviously, in the newsrooms, diversity, both in terms of sex and color and everything, is a big deal. So the newsrooms are much, much more representative now of the general population. But certainly, you know, back in the day, newsrooms were male and white. I mean, if you go back and look at any picture of a newsroom from the 50s, you don't see any women, you don't see anybody other than, you know, white men in it. So it's just like the rest of the world. Newsrooms have changed dramatically, and, you know, for the best.
Mm-hmm.
Fran, this is Phil. answering your question about that you had talked about previously about male backups, Robin Lockwood, who's in Third Victim and Perfect Alibi, one of the problems she has is that she's so physical and so used to fighting that she tends to put herself into dangerous situations. And she has a lover and Jeff, who is the investigator in her law firm. And he's a lot of the conflict there is the fact that she doesn't use male backup, that she she'll tend to go after the bad guys on her own because she's so self-confident about her physical abilities. And Jeff is always trying to rein her in and get her to, you know, use the police, use somebody else to help you. So that's a conflict that I developed between her and Jeff. So it's something that creates tension in their relationship.
Well, I hope that you're not going to break them up, because I like them. And I'm wondering if she's ever going to get in trouble where he has to actually save her, but I don't think she needs help. She's tough. I mean, she's like Caitlin Strong and Claire and Kelly and all the rest of them. I don't think they need any help. So this is my next wild question. When you created your female character, there were minor female characters in the story. How did they interact with those female characters? And do those minor characters try to upstage them? That would be a mistake, I guess.
Wow, this is John Lynn, and that is a great question, Fran.
I just thought about it.
You know, it's a great question, because when you have, no pun intended, a strong female hero, by nature, to create the right conflicts, they can only interact with strong other females in different lines of work or in different things. And what I love about what I do about Caitlin is the ambiguity, the grayness of her relationships. She may start in one book with a very strained relationship with a character that carries over into a few books. But as the series develops, a grudging respect starts to happen. It starts to evolve. The relationship, as they do in real life, begins to evolve. I'll give you another specific example, a little bit of a spoiler alert. In Strong as Steel, which is the most recent Caitlin Strong book, I wanted to do something. I wanted to define the book emotionally a new way. One of the things to do that was I introduced the character of Caitlin's half-sister that she didn't know that she had. Now, my original intent, and this is fun, and I know that other guys are going to – I wish I could say guys and girls, but it's only guys today. The other guys, I know, will smile at this because I had an intention that her half-sister was going to be a was going to be a drug addict and was going to have all these problems, and Caitlin Strong was going to – have this baggage in her life now, someone she had to take care of. Well, that didn't even get to the first page. Her half-sister becomes one of the world's greatest assassins, a killer who loves to kill. She is Caitlin's, and she is kind of Caitlin's alter ego. They look alike. They are both exceptionally strong characters. The difference being Caitlin kills when she has to. Nola Delgado kills whenever she has the opportunity to. And people, I always have a favorite scene in every book I write. There's a scene I wrote in Strong Vengeance, chapter 41, I can't even read because it scares me too much. But my favorite scene in Strong as Steel is when Caitlin and Nola, and Caitlin doesn't know it's her half-sister yet. Nola knows who Caitlin is. Caitlin doesn't know who Nola really is. They go to the ladies' room together, and they're alone. It's the first time, first off, Caitlin has ever been to the ladies' room with another woman. It's just not something that she does. It's just not Caitlin Strong. But they have this exchange, this tense, taut dialogue where they're exchanging words, like almost like bullets. And you get the sense that Caitlin's starting to figure things out. She also has great suspicions about this younger woman because the younger woman is dating one of her older surrogate sons. And she knows there's something off about her, but she doesn't know what it is and doesn't find out until much later, obviously, in the book when the twist is finally revealed. But that scene pops so well because it's so organic. Every stage direction, every bit of lighting, everything that happens in that scene just flies off the page. Because those two characters were most alive, and this is the point I wanted to get to, when they are most alive in that book, and I hadn't intended to bring Nola back, but she becomes a major character in Strong from the Heart, which will be out next year, the 11th book in the series. And the point I'm getting at is they are – nothing brings them more to life, nothing makes them pop off the page than the scenes they have together. And that's what the definition of that conflict made it so much fun. And we all write series. I think all four of us write series. Mm-hmm. And this goes to the fact that the difference between you, the only way a series can be successful and build, I just saw something that came across my email, that the Jack Reacher wasn't a New York Times bestseller until the 8th book. I thought it was much sooner than that. Somebody else, it was the 11th book. Somebody else, it was the 4th book. So you have to assume that the first few books in your series are not going to be as successful as the latter books in the series as you go on. So you have to keep challenging yourself. And you and RG, who always agrees with me, I'm sure is nodding right now, you have to challenge yourself by finding new ways to inject conflict and relationships into the story. And for me, that was Caitlin's half-sister, Nola Delgado.
Oh, damn it, John. I agree. I just want to jump in because I was going to say something to disagree with you, but unfortunately I think
no.
I agree. There's something bad going on here. Now, listen, I just wanted to say in terms of the conflict, that's, when I write other female characters with Claire Carlson, my character. That's one of the things I have to say, the toughest things, but it's something I have to really work on, which is that they have to be different. There is a natural tendency to have your characters sound alike. So you can have another Claire-type character who she's interacting with, and that's not good. I mean, you know, that the other characters, they have to talk different. Their priorities have to be different. And, you know, one of the ways you can do that is you can have the people have strengths that she doesn't have. In other words, like some of the people she works with and her best friend, they're very intense, they're very highly organized in what they do, whereas Claire is much more, you know, just all over the place and emotional. But the other thing that I have done, and I think somewhat successfully in the Claire books and also some of my earlier books, is to create female enemies, so to speak, of her. And I don't mean enemies like the criminal type enemy, but I mean within the newsroom. So like one of the things in Claire Carlson books, and Fran, you know this because you've read them, is Claire is very, very critical of, because she is a real newswoman who has made her bones in journalism and has been successful in TV journalism, she's very critical of women who aren't good journalists. So, and we all know there are women in journalism who basically are there because they look good and they sound good, but they're not really as good. They may not really be a good journalist. And so I've built up a lot of conflicts like this, and, you know, where Claire is finds out, for instance, that one of her reporters is making more money than she is because, you know, she's a big rating star, and Claire thinks the woman is an idiot. So, you know, so that's the kind of conflict that I try and deal with. And I think it's to create that kind of conflict and be critical of a woman reporter for being superficial, I think it becomes easier if the person who's critical is another woman. And you know, Claire's criticism is over the fact that, I don't care what she looks like, this woman is not a good journalist, and there are other good journalist women she does respect. So, that's something I have to work on and think about a lot in my Claire Carlson books.
I have to agree with you. You know, I could tell you what channels have women that stand up there because they look pretty and say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
sometimes I wonder if people don't stereotype people by what they look like or who they are when they're doing the news or even as a character. You know, sometimes a person comes from a specific country or something and go like, oh my God, no. And you get a whole different perspective of the character. That's just me.
Yeah.
But when you're creating your villain, and John, you're really good at this, and they come up against your female character, how does Caitlin deal with it, or how does anybody deal with a female villain? I mean, in below the fold, I mean, really, there were a whole bunch of female bad people. So how would she handle a villain?
Well,
how do they
she
handle
also does,
besides? Yeah, she also
I'll
does.
Be
I can't hear you
because I just went on for just a few minutes ago. But I think it is what she sees in that person that comes out in herself. But Caitlin, the people Caitlin takes on, and I'll give you, and the example in Strong as Steel is the woman, the Mexican crime lord known as the Red Widow. You know, the Red Widow, because she murdered all her rivals who killed her husband. Of course, you'll find out there's a twist in the end where that's not exactly the way it was. But Nola Delgado's mother, the Red Widow, is an exceptionally powerful person. She's in charge of crime. Basically, she runs the cartels in Mexico in this book. So, but Caitlin is conflicted because there is clearly some kind of bond between them because of the Red Widow's relationship with Caitlin's father. So it's ambiguous. Again, it's a gray area. Heroes are great villains make great heroes, but it's not just black and white. The Red Widow is an ambiguous character. She is clearly a villain, but she and Caitlin find an uneasy common ground. They find an alliance. When I write more pulp-oriented stories, it's a very simple formula. The hero has to topple the villain from power. When I write more complex stories, which are the Caitlin Strong books, it's not just toppling the. Sometimes you have to use the villain's power to achieve a greater end. And I think in Strong as Steel, the latest Caitlin Strong book, that's what Caitlin has to do. She has to join forces with kind of the yin, her yin and the Red Widow's yang. They have to join forces in order to get what both of them wants. It's moral complexity. And I think thrillers get a bad rap at times because people criticize us as thriller writers for lacking the moral, quote, the quote moral complexity that you may find in other types of literature. And I don't agree with that at all. I think thrillers are make for great literature, and I think some of our greatest thriller writers, like David Morrell, like James Lee Burke, are also some of our greatest novelists.
Yeah, I agree with you, but he hasn't written anything in a while, David Morrell. I mean,
he's
I read everything
collection.
That he wrote. Yeah, he does. They're fantastic. I love it, but he hasn't written anything new recently, has he?
Not in a few years, so. No.
Yeah.
No, he hasn't.
But you know, when you're talking about James Lee Burke, he is as good a writer as any contemporary literary writer, and I would say the same for Scott Turow. I reviewed one of Scott Turow's books for the Oregonian, Personal Injuries, and I started off by saying that I thought it was a shame that he was never going to get nominated for a literary prize because I thought that the Personal Injuries was as good as any literary novel I'd read, but he's been pigeonholed as a writer of legal thrillers. And I really hate genres. They're really a marketing tool for the publisher, to sell books, but for me, it's either a good book or a bad book, and James Lee Burke's writing is amazing. I mean, and so is Turow. So I sort of agree about, thrillers being pigeonholed is not, as fluff or something you read, you bring on a plane as opposed to something you read for literary merit.
I'd like to say something just about James Lee Burke, just a little footnote, which many of you probably already know, but I actually shared the same agent with him a number of years ago, and one of the great stories about him, and for all of us to know, I guess, is I think he set the all-time record for rejections before he ever got published, and I think it was somewhere around 140, I think that was the number, and he just, they couldn't get him published. And again, I shared the same agent, Philip Spitzler, who was his agent, and I. It was a legendary story of not giving up. And I believe the number, it was some gigantic number, just got rejected over and over and over again. And of course, look how it all turned out. So I just think for any kind of writer, that's a really good story to hear. You never can really give up.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up, Talentope, on something that John Land said a minute ago, talking about heroes and villains, is in some ways creating villains, whether they're female or male, and particularly even female is even more interesting. It's a lot more fun, I think, and more interesting creating the villains, I mean, rather than the heroes. I mean, I love creating both, but you have a lot of more flexibility maybe with the villains, and I think it makes for a great, great fun to do that. I don't know how others on the phone feel, but that's, I think that's particularly fun, creating villains with the flexibility.
I agree with you, because the villains sometimes are my favorite characters, seriously.
Yeah, exactly.
And I often wonder if I wish James Patterson would come on, because I just finished Unsolved. That book was unbelievable. It was one of the best ones with David Ellis. And the villain, I mean, there were so many villains in the book. It was fantastic. But I wonder sometimes how he picks his villains and creates them. So how do you guys do that? I mean, seriously.
This is Phil. I was a criminal defense lawyer for years and actually dealt with real murderers. And when I wrote Gone But Not Forgotten, I had not intended it to be a scary book. I wanted to create the worst human who'd ever lived, and I just simply did Martin Garrius the way his mentality, the way sociopaths view the world. And I used to do lunch every day with sociopaths. And after I wrote the book and it came out, people were coming up to me and saying how scary it was and how they had nightmares, and I couldn't figure it out because I hadn't intentionally sat down and said, I'm going to scare people. So in 1996, I retired from law to write full-time, and a couple weeks after I stopped practicing, a friend of mine called me up and asked me if I wanted to co-counsel a murder case. And I said, gee, you know, I'd love to, but I've retired from law and I'm writing full-time. And his first words out of his mouth were, it must be odd for you to be dealing with normal people all the time. And a little light went on, and I realized that for me, bank robbers, drug dealers, and murderers were the norm, but most people never come in contact with anyone like the type of people that I was representing, and they unnerve them. So what makes the villains more interesting than the heroes is the fact that they're a type of human that most people never encounter. It's like going to a zoo, and you know, you're in front of a leopard or a lion that could rip you to pieces, but there's bars between them. And that's what makes them fascinating, is the fact that they, if their bars weren't there, they would eat you. And so I think what makes the villains more interesting than the heroines or the heroes is the fact that they're an unusual type of person that the average reader, fortunately, never comes in contact with.
I do the same thing in some way, Philip, as you, only in a different way. I mean, you get it from your people you met in the law profession, and I do it from people's stories I've covered as a journalist. And one of the earliest stories I covered when I was a very young journalist was Son of Sam in New York, you know, the most famous serial killer. And I created a female serial killer in a book called Blonde Eyes a few years ago, which was basically, I decided, well, like, there really has never been a female serial killer like a Son of Sam. I mean, there are women who kill a lot of people for, you know, for insurance or whatever. But like a total thrill-killing woman who just kills for the thrill of it. And I created a character like that. And, you know, that was just bad, but it was fun to do, you know, because you were able to just take all these things that I remembered as being so horrible from that summer and created into a fictional character who was a woman, which, of course, allowed you to do a lot of things that you couldn't necessarily do with the original male character. So that's probably the most significant female villain that I've ever created. And that came from you know, story I covered, or the biggest story I probably ever covered in my life, which was Son of Sam.
Did you ever meet him, David Berkowitz? He was my neighborhood that he was killing in, by the way. He was killing
in
my neighborhood.
He killed in a lot of neighborhoods.
Yeah, he was killing in Pelham Parkway.
Yeah, no, I didn't know. No, I just remember, you know, I remember it happening, and then I remember, you know, obviously all the media, and then I remember the arrest.
You know, I think this is great, and I think that was RG, that was you who was just speaking, right?
That was me, yeah.
Okay, and it's great because usually you follow me. Now I get to follow you because you just made me think of something, and that is the great. For, you know, finally, turnabout is fair play. But you made me think that the greatest villains and the greatest scenes involving them don't involve violence. They don't involve necessarily physical interaction, and that's what is truly chilling. Examples.
Yeah.
The great scene in both the book and movie of No Country for Old Men, when Anton Chigurh walks into the rest stop to pay for gas and buy a candy bar. And for the next 5 minutes, he psychologically tortures the man behind the counter, the clerk, this simpleton. And out comes the coin about halfway through the scene for the first time. This creature of fate is bringing fate front and center. Think about Silence of the Lambs. They all, you know, Hannibal Lecter spends 95% of the movie, 75% of the movie, I should say, and 75% of the book behind bars. And yet those scenes with Clarice Starling are incredibly, you're on the edge of your seat and nothing is happening except that they're talking. That's the only thing. So when you can create a villain, when you who is terrifying in their thoughts and words and not necessarily their actions, maybe by what they have done in the past, but not what they are doing or how they're interacting. We shouldn't be scared of Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs because he's behind bars. We're safe, and yet we're terrified by the notion that he may get out, which, of course, in that brilliant escape scene, is what happens. So that's the high, to me, that's the highest bar of a villain. That's the bar, especially when I'm introducing a villain. I had a villain in Strong Light of Day, not a woman, but my favorite, one of my favorite villains, Callum Dane, and he's an impulsive, emotional, out-of-control individual, a billionaire, use your imagination. And there's a scene when we first meet him where he beats a one-legged young man to death with his prosthetic leg. I had no idea that scene was going to happen. It was just supposed to be a dialogue scene.
Oh, God.
But what happens in that book, Strong Light of Day, four Caitlin Strong books ago, it was organic in the sense that he decided he was going to do it. I didn't impose it upon him. He made the decision. So it's not a forced action. It's an organic action that grows out of the dialogue. So I think the greatest villains are the ones that evolve and emerge from their thoughts and words, not just their actions.
Well, that's just interesting. So your female characters, we have about another million minutes, no, about 9 or 10, or we can go over the hour. It doesn't bother me. Which type of female would your villain, would your main character not want to come up against? And you just mentioned something else about dialogue. Dialogue does help, but it's the one thing I can't seem to do. So I write my characters so they just speak, and I don't have to worry about commas and quotation marks and stuff. So what type of female character or person would they not want to come up against in your book? What would they find more difficult to go out, come up against?
I think it would be somebody, you know, similar to them. I'm just, you know, I hadn't really thought about that until you just said it. And, like, you know, I'm thinking of names. Like, I'm thinking of – no, but I'm thinking of names, like, that pop up of, like, you know, female characters that I have followed and read, and, you know, like, you know, B.A. Warshawski or, you know, Kinsey Malone from Sue Grafton and things like that. And, you know, these are real tough ladies, and yet there's an awful lot that in some ways hopefully would be similar to my character, Claire. And so I think that would be difficult. I mean, generally Claire is successful because she's able to use her strengths against people who don't have the same strength she has, whether it be verbal or what, or intelligence or what. But yeah, I think you know, there's a number of you know, I mean, including people on this panel, there's a number of people out there who write very cool, strong women characters, and I think if that would be an interesting thing. We could have all our characters go up against each other and what happens. But it's a kind of a scary thing when you think about it, because when you create a character, you kind of do it more in a vacuum. You know, you're not thinking like, oh, well, what if she had to go against this person or that person? So I think that would be difficult to do.
By the way, I did ask a couple of female authors to be on the panel, and I'm just going to ask some others to do maybe a separate show, but I did ask some other female characters, female authors, I guess, you know, what can I say? Maybe next time.
Yeah, but I want to.
But
yeah, that's a really good point that was just made, because in The Washington Operator, Kelly Cameron goes up against a very hardened Mossad agent who was born in Iran, and so the idea of going up against somebody who's a equally tough character who happens to be a woman really is what gives the book some force. And I think that was really a good point, I think, that you just made, Bilski. I really like that point. You're right.
That is good. So we have about 5 or 10 minutes or whatever. Next Tuesday, Sofia Sergova, Murmur of the Bees. Imagine when a little boy that is deformed is protected by a swarm of bees. That's all I'm going to say. It's really scary, but it's really good. And on the 27th, my last show for June until August 1st, W.H. Wheaton, Emily Eternal. What would you do if you had an artificial consciousness that took care of you? And what would you do if the sun was going to go dark completely? I found the character really interesting, and it's a strong female character, believe it or not. So, Alan, how did Elizabeth involve, and where will she be in the next Craig Page novel, hint, hint?
Right. How did she evolve? She started out as a journalist, but again, interestingly, she was one of, she's the only daughter, and her father, New York City cop, four brothers, all of them New York City cops, and she had to be tough to survive, and she did play, pitched on the boys' baseball team in high school, and she evolved as a strong character, so she became a matchup with Craig Page, and she and Craig could really sort of, she held her own and pushed back when he tried to dominate her, and I think that helped her evolve over time into even a tougher kind of character. She wasn't going to be dominated by Craig, and the playoff of their relationship becomes critical to the novels, as you know, Fran.
Bill, where do you see Robin next, and how does she, is she going to change, or are you going to bring somebody else, another female character in, and when is it coming out so I can read it?
Well, actually, the next book, A Reasonable Doubt, is the most fun I've ever had writing a book. I just signed a three-book contract with St. Martin, so I'm going to have at least six Robins because I really enjoy the character. But in A Reasonable Doubt, a magician is murdered on stage in front of a packed audience while performing the Chamber of Death, his biggest magic illusion. And you don't know who the killer is. So I had to, A, figure out or learn, which is fun. I love magic. I had to learn how to do a big David Copperfield-type illusion.
Oh, nice.
And then I had to figure out how you would kill someone in full view of an audience with, say, 3,000 people watching, and no one knows who the killer is. So it's in the editing stage now. It's in New York with my editor, Keith Kayla, and I'll be getting it back. But they already have the cover. It's sort of fun. They did a really spooky cover. It's on already on Amazon. You can get it. It was just so much fun. I have a friend of mine who's a judge, Marshall Amaton, who's also an amateur magician. And he has a friend who is also a lawyer and an amateur magician. And they explained to me how you would get someone out of a locked coffin that's where they're lying in a locked coffin with snakes and scorpions, how they would get out and disappear. And then I had to figure out on my own how to kill the guy, and nobody knows who did it.
Well, that sounds interesting. That is really, I can't wait to read it. You know me. The scary, not the scarier. So, John, where do you see my Caitlin next, and when are you bringing back Blake McCracken? Seriously.
Ha. Actually,
I know, I had to throw that in.
No, I'm glad you did, because I just had lunch with one of the people I revere in this world, which is Tom Doherty, my publisher. Macmillan just moved offices, so I thought to commemorate Macmillan moving offices after 30 years, whatever it was, in the Flatiron Building. I actually raised the possibility of doing a book where McCracken and Caitlin Strong share the stage. I don't know if I'm going to do it. You know, it's a very dangerous thing to do. I don't know how many of the other people, RG, Philip, Alan, have thought about teaming up people from past books. Other authors have tried it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But this is a tough business, and sometimes you need to give the sales department of your company a marketing hook, because it's tough to sell books today, but that's a topic for another show.
But I still think you should bring Jessica with Caitlin at some time, too. Sorry, got to have it.
We never even mentioned Jessica today. That's interesting.
You did? Did you miss the real Angela Lansbury? I would love her to come on when you do your next show about the book. That would be really, just to see what she thinks. So, RG, where do you see Claire next, and what's the next one, and when am I getting it? Because I know Ocean View is just going to send it, but we got to make sure
right.
I get it.
Right, you're at the top of the list, Fran. Always.
I hope so.
The next one is called The Last Scoop, and it'll be out, next spring, and so presumably probably at some point, hopefully by the end of summer or early fall, you'll get a you'll get an advanced copy. And, you know, in terms of her involvement, I mean, Claire, and there's two sides, one of which is her personal side, which I don't really want to get into too much here because it's such a part of this continuing storyline. But she has, like, some, you know, very important personal issues she's trying to deal with in terms of her past and family and children and things, you know, those kinds of decisions. But in terms of the professional thing, she's also very agonized, and I play on this a lot in The Last Scoop, too, which is she's basically a reporter at heart who's got a really good job as the news director of a TV station, but the news director of a TV station doesn't really do any reporting. I mean, you know, you're sitting there doing budgets and ratings, and I sort of wrote myself in a corner on this because I originally did it as a standalone, and now, you know, you have to, okay, well, why is she out reporting? And, it, you know, I always said it's a little bit like McMillan and Wife, I think, or something, you know, where he's the police commissioner, but he's actually out solving crime. So she's torn both ways, both between being executive and being what she really loves, which is, the journalism part of it and doing the story. So I really focus on that a lot in all the books, but certainly in the next one, The Last Scoop.
That is good. So before we end, where can we find out about everybody? And how can everybody learn more about each one of you? And yes, we went over the hour, but we don't care. That's okay.
All right, I'll start. I'm at www.rgbelsky.com and also on Facebook at RG Belsky. And you can also find me, you know, a bunch of other places. But those are the main author pages I have.
It's Alan Topol. I'm at www.alantopol, alantopol.com, and it features the newest book, The Washington Operator, which just came out and is available on Amazon, both paper and digital.
And Phil?
Phil Margolin. I'm a techno idiot. I don't even know how to get on my own Facebook. But if you just Google Phil Margolin, I actually have a Facebook page. I don't know how to get on, but
I do. I do.
My books are sold all over, and I have a website, and the books are on Amazon and Barnes and Noble or in bookstores wherever you go. So hopefully you have a 9-year-old grandkid or something who can get you onto my website.
Oh, by the way, Phil, my doctor read A Perfect Alibi, and so did the judge that he knows, and they loved it. They said to tell you that they thought it was one of your best. Seriously. And Uncle Len is reading yours, RG, because he's my book partner. I think I sent him John's also, and he loves it too, so they love me forever. So, John, where can we find out more about you? And, yeah, I'm glad you're thinking about bringing Blake and Caitlin together. That would be interesting.
You know, it's kind of like a story born of another story born of a marketing tool. I'm with Phil on this, even though, you know, I have a website. I don't keep it up very well, and it only contains information I want you to read. So if you want to find out about me, I like the Google thing. You know, Google me or Google the latest book. You know, Google Strong as Steel. Google Murder, you know, Murder, She Wrote. I mean, read the Amazon reviews, even though one of my most recent Murder, She Wrote book is doing well, been very well received. My last one got as many one-star reviews, more one-star reviews than all my other books combined.
Oh, God.
But you know what? You can learn something from reading those reviews because they go to the fact that I'm writing them differently than they were written before. So they're accurate in that respect, even though they're even though they hate me. If you want to find out stuff objectively about Caitlin Strong or what I'm doing with Jessica Fletcher and Murder, She Wrote, you know, Google, you know, just use Google, and that's the best way to get an objective idea, an objective read, no pun intended.
Well,
like,
for those of you that don't know,
the best ones. My favorite review ever is, this book was so bad that my cat could have written it, and I've been trying to get the cat so I can play more golf.
I agree with you. I think the worst review I ever got for Faces Behind the Stone, the first one, was, this book is great, but I don't understand it, so I'm going to give it 2 stars. And I didn't read the whole book. I said, so I'll take it as half a review, not a problem. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. So Silent Voices came out June 9th, and it's my fifth in the series, and it's told from the point of view of the person that's deceased behind the gravestone, and three of the stories are based on real-life events, and the other four are my imagination, if you can call it that. I want to thank everyone. As I'm sitting here, I'm trying to think of more panel shows to do. We've done setting or whatever. The one thing that annoys me when I'm reading a book is, A, it's too many pages, like 800, and the font is too small, and I need a magnifying glass. Seriously? That drives me crazy. And the other thing is when she's sitting and having her coffee, she blew her coffee, she's chewing on gum, and I can't stand that. That drives me crazy, too. So I'm thinking about, something similar to that. What happens when a book is too long? Does it sort of kill the plot? And what happens when there's too much, moving around that has nothing to do with anything? That drives me crazy, too, and I'm reading books like that now. But for those of you that want to know what to read, pick every one of these authors. And Just Reviews, in a couple of months, is going to come out with their Book of the Years and their awards, and you can almost guess who's going to be on it. So I want to thank everyone for today. Thank you so much. This has been fun. And everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Everybody. Thank you, friend. Thanks. Bye-bye.